sake. What's the date today?
April 2nd.
April 2nd. It's about 9:40 in the morning on April 2nd. We're here with John Hawk, the former comptroller of the currency, at the headquarters of Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C. We're here to talk in advance of the first hearing that the commission's going to have on subprime securitization, and Citibank is one of the case studies that we're doing. This isn't a deposition. This is for us to get a bit up the learning curve. So if I ask a question, obviously, if you don't understand it, ask me to rephrase it.
Sure.
But more importantly, if I ask a question and you think there's a better question, and feel free to go off into that area and tell me what you think is important to the underlying crisis. I've got a few documents here with me today, mostly on sort of the evolution of the subprime guidance, one Citibank exam report, and the formal agreement relating to the Enron situation. So I want to go through some of those with you today.
Okay.
But I guess, one last reminder is that because we are the federal commission, we're covered by 18 U.S.C. 1001, the same federal statute that covers the OCC examiners, and I'm sure you're well familiar with. So before I go through sort of my questions on subprime lending, preemption, and Citibank, I'd like you to just give me your general thoughts on the financial crisis, whatever that means, how we got there, and how we can avoid going down that road again.
Before I start, what's the date of the subprime guidance?
The very first one is March 99.
Yeah, okay.
And then there was expanded guidance in 2001,
right.
And then two advisory letters
right.
by the OCC on the same date, February 2003. And then after your departure in July of 07, the uniform
right.
statement by the agencies.
Well, I welcome the opportunity to chat with you, and I think you're doing an important job, and I hope I can be helpful. I must say, memory dims over time, and it's 10 years or more since some of these events occurred. And as far as Citigroup is concerned, Citibank, I'm not sure I have an understanding or a recollection, rather, of specifics, but I'll try to be helpful. But let me start with just some more general comments. I took office late in 1998, I believe it was, and the topic of securitizations was not one that was in the forefront of my consciousness at the time. I think probably the first thing that the first event that sensitized me to issues relating to securitizations was the activities at a small bank in Pennsylvania called Keystone National Bank. Keystone was under significant stress. Our examiners were bearing down on them. The bank, through its lawyer, who happened to be a former controller, came to me and said they thought that our examiners were biased and I should send a whole new examination team in. Which I did not do. Our examiners bore down and found that half of Keystone's billion-dollar balance sheet was fictitious. And that resulted from their involvement in securitization. So the head of Keystone thought that securitizing what we later came to call subprime loans, was a great way to make money. They were totally incompetent at it. They were buying loans from all over the country with very poor underwriting. And as loans started to go bad, the bank came under significant pressures. They had an outside loan servicer who was handling the loans and servicing the loans and giving reports to the bank. It turned out that the bank was altering those reports to make their balance sheet look more substantial than it was. And the long and short of it was, and when our examiners discovered the fraud, we closed the bank, and it was a substantial failure. But that heightened my concern about securitizations, and I had the sense that the banking agencies generally were, and I believe this was the middle of 1999, I can't be sure about the dates, that the banking agencies generally were not highly sophisticated about securitizations. And so I initiated an interagency program, a two-day program on securitizations, where we got experts in to talk about what securitizations were all about. And we had attendees from all of the banking agencies. And I don't mean to downplay the expertise or sophistication of any of our colleagues, but reflecting more on my own awareness of things. But that was a very valuable conference, and it began to focus our attention on what securitizations were all about. During the time that I was in office, the issue of securitization of subprime mortgages and the collateral damage that did wasn't high on my radar screen. I believe that those developments really occurred in subsequent years, even though some of the seeds may have been sown during that time. We started to look more closely at securitizations, including securitizations in the credit card business. I think the agency's level of understanding and awareness, the learning curve was fairly sharp during that period of time. Now, sort of stepping back from that, there are just a couple of observations. One, the thing that really drove securitization, or the two things that drove securitizations. One, looking at it from the bank's point of view, securitization was a way of generating more revenues through the process of acting as a conduit for loans and realizing gains on the sale of loans into securitization pools. But that all depended on the accounting rules. The accountants had rules relating to what they called true sale that basically said that we will treat the disposition of an asset as a sale and therefore recognize that you can take it off your books. You don't have to record it on your books if certain preconditions are met. And there couldn't be any contractual indemnifications or guarantees, anything that represented a retention of an explicit liability on the part of the bank. The regulators followed the accounting rules. If the accountant said this was true sale, then the regulators treated the disposition of the asset as sufficient to avoid the imposition of capital on the asset, and that was really the whole purpose of securitizations. It was to generate more lending activity without increasing capital. I think in retrospect that the agencies, that the regulators were not sufficiently attuned to the real risks, or some of the real risks in securitizations, even though the true sale rules were observed. And we saw that in a number of years later when the assets that went into these securitizations started to go bad. While there was no contractual obligation on the part of the bank to take the loans back, the custodians in the securitization pools, the trustees, would rely on the representations and warranties that were made when the assets were sold, and they would say, well, you know, there was fraud in this loan, and that's a violation of the representations and warranties. Therefore, you've got to take this back. And I think tens, if not hundreds of thousands of loans were the securitization pools called on the banks to buy back tens, if not hundreds of thousands of loans at an enormous cost. And so there was a risk to the bank that was never foreseen by anybody, the regulators, the underwriters, the rating agencies, let alone the investors in the securitizations. I think we probably could have done a better job in assessing or in kind of predicting the risks against which capital should have been held in securitizations. Now that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, that's easy to say. Nobody at that point predicted the debacle. The other point is that I think there was a real change in the dynamic of the whole mortgage business over a period of time. There was a time when the demand for mortgages reflected the desires of real people to own homes, and you know they would go into their bank and or their mortgage company and get a conventional kind of amortizing mortgage and pay it off over 30 years, and the lender may or may not sell the mortgage into the secondary market, or they may keep it on their books. If they kept it on their books, their underwriting was generally reflected the kinds of risks that they had. Over time, that process changed, and I think the change was driven largely by the investment bankers. When it became evident that there were tremendous fees to be made in the process of securitization, the investment bankers created a greater and greater demand for product to securitize, so the demand, in a sense, instead of being from the bottom up, started coming from the top down, and with that dynamic of the process changing, the underwriting standards of previous times, where banks were careful about underwriting loans that they were going to keep on their books, really changed quite a bit. The mortgage brokers who were originating the loans didn't care about the underwriting at all. They got fees for generating product. The banks were conduits, and the stuff was going through their books. They as long as they satisfied the true sale requirements, they could book a gain on the sale of the asset into the securitization pool. So the stuff didn't stay on their books for very long. The investment bankers, I don't think, were particularly expert in underwriting mortgage loans, and in a sense, the underwriting was less important to them because they were dividing the risk up into a number of different tranches, and the AAA tranches had everything else in the pool subordinated to them. They had the first claim on cash flows and on assets in liquidation, and So they were very safe, and they bore a low interest rate to reflect that. At the bottom of the waterfall was highly risky stuff that people afraid of triple B or something. And the conventional underwriting of risk wasn't occurring in the same way as it did. And with interest rates being kept very low by the Fed, it drove the mortgage market, which enabled the investment bankers to cause the generation of a lot more mortgage product. And one aspect of this change in the dynamic was the change in the way loans were structured. I didn't see much of this during my time. Although it was by the end of my tenure, we were beginning to see some signs of the development of alternative mortgage instruments. I remember an occasion where I used to have weekly meetings with my staff, with my credit staff. And they would present different issues. And one morning, I got a briefing on alternative mortgage instruments. And they were describing how some lenders were offering a whole variety of different formulations for mortgages. You could pay interest only for several years before the mortgage started amortizing. And then you could pay a sub-market rate of interest, and the difference between that and the market rate got added to principal. But 3 years or 5 years down the line, the terms of the mortgage reset. You had to the borrower had to pay a market rate on a fully amortizing loan. And I raised the question about how the banks were underwriting those loans. Were they looking at the borrower's ability to handle the initial payments? That's certainly what the borrowers were looking at. Or were they looking at the borrower's ability to handle the reset payment several years down the line based on, you know, different assumptions that could be made about that? And I was told it was just the former. And I said, Jesus, that's crazy. That's got to stop. Because banks ought to be looking at what happens when the loan kicks in. At a fully amortized market rate. So our examiners went back to some of the banks, and they got a lot of pushback from the banks. The banks said, you know, first of all, that's speculative. We don't know what the conditions are going to be 3 years down the line, although they could have made a variety of different assumptions. And second, if the borrower can't afford the new payments, we can always sell the house. The borrower can cash his equity out, and since real estate prices only go up, you know, there's no exposure to anybody. But we had that confrontation with the banks, and our examiners began to push for an expanded kind of loan underwriting. So. Those are kind of general comments on the process.
Well, one other thought has occurred to me before we dive into the subprime arc of documents here, and that's functional regulation and Gramm-Leach-Bliley. Talking to the other staff, former, current at the OCC, as well as the Federal Reserve, a sort of common refrain I've heard is angst at the inability to get easy access to information from regulators from each other. The OCC examiners I've talked to express frustration that post Gramm-Leach-Bliley, when you look at the largest institutions like Citigroup, Citibank, that they run their businesses as a business line. You know, it's like the global consumer and investment bank. And it sort of stretches across legal entities. and you'll see the investment bankers taking something to the Capital Markets Approval Committee, and they're the guys pushing the deal. But as you read through the documentation, you know, the credit default swap or the liquidity put, which is the key to making things go, ends up on the balance sheet of the bank, because the bank is often the preferred funding vehicle, because third-party creditors and derivative counterparties feel more comfortable with the bank's credit exposure than the broker-dealer. And so OCC examiners would say, well, you know, yeah, we knew there were credit default swaps and liquidity puts, but, you know, all we knew was that these were AAA-rated super senior CDOs. We weren't examining the broker-dealer. That, you know, the Fed may have gotten its sort of light umbrella look, but it was the SEC that was down there as the functional regulator. And they switched at one point from sort of running it as a agency business, setting it up for other people, and turned it into a principal business where they were holding stuff. And we had no idea that this was going on. And you know, when the things eventually blew up and came back onto the bank's balance sheet because of this sort of same sort of thing you were talking about with the reps and warranties, the same sort of things happened with the liquidity puts. The assets came bouncing back unexpectedly. The examiners were sort of caught flat-footed. They had no idea that this was going on. Meanwhile, folks at the Federal Reserve will say that, you know, given the deference they're supposed to show the functional regulators, they don't take as deep a dive into the depository institutions or the regulators as they used to.
Oh, jeez.
And so they say, you know, we have to just rely on whatever the SEC tells us. We have to rely on whatever the OCC tells us. So, you know, we don't understand the things as well as we should. Was there any sort of that intramural tension between the agencies when you were, because you were on the scene right when this thing was getting implemented, you know, the Graham-Leach-Bliley?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't think Graham-Leach-Bliley had anything to do with the debacle. I think those who say that deregulation was a cause of the crisis, I think are just way off base. Graham-Leach-Bliley did one thing. It allowed Citigroup to keep Travelers. The Fed had allowed them to acquire Travelers subject to a requirement
right.
that they divest it within 2 years if the legislation wasn't passed. The legislation was passed. They kept it.
Right.
Other than that, I think Graham-Leach-Bliley was pretty much a dead letter. In terms of if
one wanted to make the argument that it was deregulation, it was the Fed's regulatory moves beginning actually before Greenspan in 86 up until 97, where they were creating the exceptions for the Section 20.
That's right, exactly.
So if you want to say that the investment bank getting its nose under the tent was the problem, it certainly wasn't Graham-Leach-Bliley.
Right.
That's exactly
right. And I've made that point a number of times, that Graham-Leach-Bliley did not facilitate activity that wasn't already permissible under the Fed's Section 20 interpretations. That's absolutely right. And the paradox is that with the crisis, with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley all becoming bank holding companies, they couldn't have done that without Graham-Leach-Bliley.
Right.
But other than Travelers, Graham-Leach-Bliley, I think, was a dead letter.
But talk to me about the functional regulation aspect of Graham-Leach-Bliley, because that was in the statute. And according to the examiners,
right.
that had an effect on their work.
Graham-Leach-Bliley was passed in 1999, I guess.
Right.
And I must say, I didn't see that. Now, to be sure, there were different relationships in each Federal Reserve district. In some districts, our large bank examiners had very good, very cooperative working relationships with their counterparts at the Fed. In others, the relationships were a little bit more standoffish, but it was not that the Fed was being kept out. It was that the Fed was mucking around in the banks and sort of stepping on the feet of our examiners. They were asking questions that had already been asked, or we're going off on tangents that our guys had already looked at. In City, I think we probably had 40 or 45 on-site, full-time examiners.
Right.
The Fed maybe had 12 or 15.
Right.
And they were located right next door. My sense was that relationship in City was quite good. That they were cooperative. That they coordinated. And I'm not aware of. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just, it didn't come to my attention that there was any hiding of information or denial of access to information in either direction.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we start going through some of these subprime documents. The first one we'll start with are the interagency guidelines dated March 1st, 1999. Wow. So why don't you take just a few seconds to refamiliarize yourself. At least take a look and read the background and scope section.
Okay.
Why don't you tell me what you recall about the process leading up to the issuance of these guidelines?
Securitizations are mentioned in this guidance, but. They were not the driving force behind this. Our examiners and FDIC examiners as well were increasingly concerned about subprime lending, not in the context of securitizations, but in the context of banks making subprime loans and keeping them on their books. The head of supervision at the FDIC at that time was a fellow named Jim Sexton. And Jim was a sort of old-style bank examiner. And from his previous experience, I think he'd been the banking superintendent in Texas. He had a great aversion to subprime lending. And we agreed with him. And we started agitating for some sort of... guidance to banks on subprime lending. We had a hard time getting the Fed to come along with this. I remember the interagency process went on for quite a while, and there were a lot of negotiations, and we finally got agreement on this statement that came out in March of 99. But the focus was on portfolio lending.
Right,
and the key paragraph I think is on the second page. The two first paragraphs on the second page, subprime loans. The second full paragraph. Institutions should recognize the additional risk inherent in subprime lending and determine if those risks are acceptable and controllable. That was, you know, really the message that we wanted to get across.
So as I view this document, it's focused on subprime lending mainly from the safety and soundness aspect, and it touches upon, but clearly I think a lesser importance of the consumer protection piece. Would you say that's a fair assessment of this document?
Well, let's see. There is a section called...
Yeah, page 5 and top of page 6, it does talk about consumer protection.
Yeah, well, that was a concern that, I mean, I think the principal concern that we had was this issue of steering, that some borrowers who could have qualified for better terms were being steered into higher rate subprime loans.
And do you know who at the Fed was... sort of the lead on this? Was it really Spillenkothen or I mean...
Yeah, I just don't recall.
Yeah. Do you know if Greenspan had any... Do you recall any
conversations? Oh, I would be very surprised if Greenspan basically had no interest in and didn't know anything about bank supervision. He was... which has been typical of most Fed chairmen.
Right. One former head of the supervision department of the Federal Reserve called the Federal Reserve an institution that's run by economists for economists, and has said that economists tend to have a natural inclination to be suspicious of any regulation because they view it as imposing costs and that everything has to be justified. Is that sort of from viewing outside the walls?
That may be an oversimplification. I spent 3 years at the Fed as general counsel, and when Arthur Burns was chairman. And these issues of consumer protection and some of the routine supervisory issues were not as important, certainly to the chairman, as issues of monetary policy and concerns about keeping the Fed independent. And when you got into questions of bank supervision and regulation, they tended to have a political component to them that caused controversy, and the Fed never has liked controversy. The irony is that the reserve banks, the substance of the reserve banks was focused on bank supervision. I mean, they had their cadres of economists, but the real staffing at the reserve banks was the supervisory staff.
Right. Okay, let's go to the next document, which is in the form of a press release from the FDIC and the OCC and the Board of Governors and the OTS.
What's the date on this?
And the date of this is on the top, January 31st, 2001, and this was
expanded guidance.
And why don't you just take a few seconds and skim this? My understanding here is that it was sort of aimed at additional capital for institutions that were focused on subprime lending
and loan loss reserve adequacy.
Right.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly what precipitated this, but it was about this time that we were having.
There were some losses beginning to show up at some of the major banks.
Well, we were beginning to have problems with the accountants and with the SEC about loan loss reserve provisioning, I guess that's not really addressed in here, I just don't recall. This does address predatory lending,
right?
And that term is I think, misused or misunderstood in a lot of sense. But this paragraph on page 7, it says the term subprime is often misused to refer to certain predatory abusive lending practices. It is an important point. We can discuss when we get to the preemption questions, but which we addressed in the preemption context. But I think understanding that difference between predatory lending and subprime lending was important, and it was one of the things that we were trying to get across here.
One of the things that's usually included under the basket and is here referenced is loan flipping, where it says inducing a borrower to repeatedly refinance. Can you tell me what your thoughts are about the so-called hybrid arms, the 228s, and whether or not structurally those are sort of a form of loan flipping the way they were constructed, where they had a reset date where typically in 2 or 3 years, and then the indexed rate at that point would result in a payment shock of 500 or 600 basis points, generally, so that the borrower's payment would go up between 50% and 100% on the reset. And the consumer groups essentially say that it was kind of a structural form of loan flipping built into the structure of the product itself. Do you have a view on that?
I really don't recall any discussion that reached me on that. But this issue of without calling it loan flipping, inducing a borrower to refinance, predatory lending really hit home with me after I made a visit to the west side of Chicago. We toured around with some of the community groups and talked to people in neighborhoods that had been where people had been victimized by unscrupulous loan originators, and they were really the non-regulated brokers who were doing this. They would actually track the equity in people's houses, and when somebody had built up enough equity to make it worth going after, they would come in and induce borrowers to refinance, to take that equity out to do home improvements and the like, or if they built up equity again to refinance. And there was a much higher than normal incidence of defaults and foreclosures in those. That's what we focused on as predatory lending. Lending that was not based on the borrower's ability to pay, but on the amount of equity in the property.
So the 2000-2001 time frame is kind of interesting because you see different institutions taking different approaches. Citigroup in 2000 sort of plunges whole hog into subprime lending. That's when they acquired the associates, and this is under the holding company structure, and it becomes Citi Financial.
Right.
And at the time of the merger, they were 25% larger than the second largest subprime lender. On the other hand, you had B of A in 2001 essentially discontinuing its subprime lending operations. They determined that on their model, they couldn't make money on a risk-adjusted basis. Mm-hmm. Do you recall, sort of at that time, what your thoughts were about essentially the largest banks, the ones that were either going in or leaving the subprime lending, whether...
No, I really don't. If it was not in the bank, it was not something that I was likely to hear about.
Right. Okay, let's go to the next two documents. They're issued on the same date, February 21, 2003. One deals with predatory and abusive lending practices, loan originations, and the other deals with predatory and abusive lending with respect to purchased loans, essentially. Can you tell me what you recall about the development of these two advisories? And take your time.
Yeah, this is the the second page talks about equity stripping. This really reflects what I was just talking about.
And which document are you referring to?
The,
dash 2 or dash 3?
Dash 2.
Okay. Right. So that describes what was going on when you went and looked at the Chicago situation. Do you recall the time frame of that for Chicago?
I don't really. It was obviously before this. Well, I don't recall specifically what generated these advisories, but the we were, of course, getting an increasing amount of attention paid to state predatory lending laws, and this issue of preemption came up, and we wanted to be sure that we were not kind of caught in the switches where state laws were being subjected to preemption, and there was nothing at our level that was left to fill the gap, because we were aware of practices that could be defined as predatory lending, even though, as we say here, we didn't have reason to believe that national banks or their operating subsidiaries were generally engaged in predatory lending practices. That was true. We had not seen evidence that national banks were engaged in it. But this was kind of an attempt to be prophylactic about it.
Okay, let's go on to the final document.
Is this the preemption, right?
No. This occurred after. This is the.
Yeah. You don't have the preemption regulation?
No, I brought your preemption statement, not the regulation.
The January 2003.
The July 2003 preemption statement regarding the Georgia laws.
Yeah, and we put out an important part of this is the regulation we put out in January 2004.
Right. But before I get to the preemption, I want to cover the final interagency statement on subprime lending in 2007. What this did effectively was require what you had mentioned earlier, the depository institutions to underwrite to the fully indexed rate, and it also put limits on prepayment penalties. And it was focused mostly on these what are called hybrid arms, the 228s and 327s. And it said that you had to have the borrowers underwritten to the indexed, fully indexed payment, and you couldn't have prepayment penalties last beyond the conversion point. And this was issued in July 2007. And shortly thereafter, all the major national banks that had been offering these products stopped. So JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, B of A's City Mortgage Unit, stop issuing those products when this interagency guidance came out. And I don't know if you've sort of followed the history of those products as we've gone through this crisis, but the default rates are pretty scary. The numbers I've seen are in excess of 40% default rates.
Well, of course, things were changing in the marketplace. I mean, the overbuilding in the housing market was becoming obvious, and values were dropping. So,
Given that you obviously had the concern early on about riding to the fully indexed rate,
yeah.
Did you try and push for that on an interagency basis in any of the earlier?
I don't recall if we discussed that on an interagency basis or not. I was mostly concerned about getting the word through our examiners back to the banks. And as far as I know, they were doing that because I was getting reports and feedback from the banks who were complaining that we were trying to get them to do something that was problematic from their point of view and not necessary because housing prices only go up.
Right. Well, one of the larger national banks that was heavily into the hybrid arms was the National City Bank of Ohio and its subsidiary
First Franklin.
That it acquired in 1999. My understanding from the general literature is that First Franklin sort of invented the 228 subprime loan, and it was approximately 90% of their product mix. So they were all over that segment of the market. After your tenure, the OCC took some enforcement action against them. Do you recall during your tenure whether examiners evidenced concern or spoke to you, or do you have any recollection about problems at National City?
I don't recall problems. I recall a visit to Nat City, and I suspect our examiner in chief of that bank was present at the meeting, although I don't recall exactly who was there. But I remember talking with them about their getting into, I think probably their First Franklin acquisition was fairly new at the time of that visit. And I remember that we were concerned about whether they were managing that business probably, but I don't recall any specifics of that. I know that that our people were focusing on it when they made that acquisition.
So you don't recall it being sort of any sort of continual source of tension, at least at your level, with an ongoing issue that the guys at National City aren't doing things right and we need to...
I don't recall that, no.
Okay.
I recall just that one meeting where we expressed concern about it and we were briefed on the acquisition.
The acquisition of First Franklin. All right, so the next document I'd like to turn to is the preemption determination. This precedes the regulation, so why don't you take a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the Georgia law was fairly expansive, covered, had assignee liability and a lot of things beyond sort of what are viewed as predatory practices. But why don't you tell me what you can remember about what led up to the preemption determination that was issued in July 2003 on behalf of or in response to National City.
We were beginning to see these so-called predatory lending laws being adopted in a number of states, and the Georgia one rose to this level, I think, because Nat City had requested a determination from us, but this was just one of a number of similar kinds of laws that were appearing in different states. But let me just say a couple words about preemption, because
sure.
This is probably the appropriate place to
sure.
to do that. And I think this statement is a pretty good summary of what I would say. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that the controller has no power to preempt a state law. The preemption is a constitutional doctrine, and where preemption occurs, it occurs by reason of the operation of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause. And it's ever since McCulloch versus Maryland, the constitutional doctrine has been that the states don't have the authority to regulate the federally authorized activities of entities that are created under federal law. Congress can change that, and there are certainly examples where Congress has made federal instrumentalities like national banks subject to various kinds of state laws. But absent some congressional determination that they should be subject to state law, federal instrumentalities are not. And that's a doctrine that has applied in many, many different cases, many, many, many different types of activities over the years. What we were seeing during my time was that states and localities were becoming much more active in attempting to control or regulate or affect the banking activities of national banks, and we viewed that as running straight into the constitutional principle. And since I had taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, and because this was an important aspect of the National Bank Charter, we were frequently in a position of having to opine on whether a particular state or local enactment was applicable to national banks. For example, in California, there were some municipalities that tried to prohibit the imposition of ATM surcharges. Where a bank would impose a surcharge on the use of an ATM by a person who was not a customer of that bank, that these laws attempted to prohibit that, and they attempted to make that applicable to national banks. We thought that they couldn't do that violated the constitutional prohibition. And there were a variety of other different types of state or local enactments that were purported to be applicable to all banks, including national banks. I should say many of these had sort of recognized the preemption problem because they had provisions in them saying that if it's determined that this is not applicable to national banks, then it won't be applicable to state banks either. But there were many, many cases where we expressed an opinion on preemption. The Georgia case was really that. It was an opinion of the Comptroller's Office. Many of these cases were litigated, and some of these opinions were issued in the context of litigation. And I can't think of one of those cases that we lost. There may have been one, but court after court upheld the controller's expression of opinion that a particular law was preempted. I think it's important to recognize that we did not have the automatic authority to preempt a state law, that it was ultimately a court that had the ability to interpret the constitutional provisions that had that authority. We certainly had the authority to express an opinion, which is what we did in the Georgia case, but our opinion carried whatever weight the court decided to give to it if that was an issue that was raised in court.
And so you felt bound to seek preemption for national banks?
Right? Absolutely. As I say, I took an oath to uphold the Constitution, and this was a constitutional constitutional doctrine. I couldn't waive the constitutional imperative that the states don't have the authority to regulate the banking activities of national banks. That would have been a dereliction of duty on my part.
Did you feel similarly bound with respect to state chartered operating subsidiaries to which the OCC also extended preemption, or is that something where the OCC had some discretion and you exercised your discretion to?
No, I don't think it was. It was not something that we had the automatic authority to do. That issue arose. Our view was that the operating subsidiary was simply an incorporated division of the bank. Operating subsidiaries could only exercise those powers that were granted to the bank, and they could only exercise those powers at places that the bank could exercise those powers. We viewed the operating subsidiary as essentially an integral part of the bank, and our view was that if preemption applied to the bank, it applied to the operating subsidiary as well. Now, Gramm-Leach Bliley permitted subsidiaries of banks to engage in a broader range of activities than were authorized for the bank itself. Those were called financial subsidiaries, and I think it was clear that financial subsidiaries were not subject to the same preemption analysis that an operating subsidiary was.
So I'm not sure. So do you think you were compelled for the op subs to?
Yeah, I mean, there was initially an issue of interpretation. I mean, does the constitutional provision apply to the operating subsidiary? We concluded that it did on the reasoning that I just described, and our view was, I believe this was litigated. I think we won it, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember the case, but our view was that the operating the use of the state corporate charter to carry out the activity was simply a ministerial act and a way of creating a division of the bank that engaged in only in those activities that the bank could engage in.
So, why don't you tell me what led to the development of the preemption reg versus sort of this case-by-case issuance?
Well, it was just that we were being faced with a number of different individual cases, and there was this proliferation of state efforts to apply regulatory laws to national banks. It was creating a lot of uncertainty in the industry, and we felt it was important to try to set out what we saw as the principles that were applicable in these cases. But they were coming up all over the place. I mentioned the ATM surcharge. Right. Well, I mean, there were I can't remember all the details of the other ones, but there were. I remember in California, up in your neck of the woods, there were other kinds of laws that that the state was trying to apply to national banks on lending activities not predatory lending laws, but other kinds of, what the hell were they? I've got maybe some of them had to do with foreclosures. I don't recall, but what the specifics were. But we were seeing these efforts arising in a number of different places around the country, and that's what led to the preemption regulation.
But again, this
was expressing our view and our interpretation. It was really up to, and we recognized right from the start, it was up to the courts to determine whether we had made a correct interpretation of the Constitution.
So let's go on to the visitorial powers issue. That's the position that the OCC took, that state attorney generals couldn't access information through subpoena or subpoena-like requests for documents. And that's one that eventually
went to the Supreme
Court, and Justice Scalia was the author of the opinion where he said that the OCC's stance was, I believe his word was, bizarre. Doesn't like to mince words. So in that instance, the court said that the OCC had overreached.
Yeah, that was not. I don't view that as a preemption case. That was a statutory interpretation case, and I mean the issue was whether what Spitzer was trying to do was visitation or not, and Scalia and his cosmic wisdom decided that it was not, and that the statute didn't apply.
So nobody says that preemption caused this crisis, but there are people that say that preemption is applied to institutions like National City and their subsidiaries at First Franklin. Certainly didn't help in some isolated geographic areas, and that the OCC's sort of generalized statements about equity stripping and loan flipping were not followed up with sort of specific supervisory efforts or efforts like the 2007 reg that said, you know, don't do 228s unless they're fully indexed, which no one was doing at the time. And so that you had sort of during the height of the run rate of these subprime loans, the 2003 to mid-2007 period, that some portion of that could have been curtailed by the national bank regulators if they had adopted something similar to the July 2007 reg back when they were doing the earlier guidance.
Yeah.
If they had cut the legs off on this securitization originate to distribute model where underwriting standards were just ignored if they'd acted similar.
I think a lot of that developed after I had left office, but there's a lot of revisionist history going on here. I don't think these state anti-predatory lending laws really dealt with the core causes of the problem. I think they were intended to deal with the kind of predatory lending that we defined and we talked about earlier. And A, we hadn't seen evidence of that in national banks, and B, we had been, I think, quite forthright in describing our views on it. I should say that as this preemption thing heated up, we tried to strike an arrangement with the state AGs that would serve both of our interests. We had a big meeting, I remember, with a bunch of state AGs in which, you know, we expressed our views on preemption and they expressed their views. And I said, well, you know, why can't we try to work together? If you have evidence that national banks, and we repeatedly asked them for evidence that national banks were engaged in any of these practices, and we got zero. We never got any references from state AGs that national banks were doing things that we should know about. Zero. We suggested to them that maybe we could enter into an arrangement. I think we even tried to draft a proposed form of agreement with them to refer cases to us or to share information, and we got stiffed on that. They actually did that a number of years later. I think within the last couple of years, John Dugan was able to enter into an arrangement like that. But they refused to enter into any kind of information sharing arrangement with us, because they were more interested in trying to. And I think Spitzer was really driving this. They were trying to vindicate their position on the merits.
Do you recall what year or that when that meeting might have been? Was it 2003?
It was before. Well, I left in 2004, so it was 2002 or 3, it was somewhere in there.
Okay. And what was the? Was it here in D.C.?
Yeah, it was in my office. I think the guy from North Carolina and the fellow from
Roy
Iowa.
Roy Cooper, I think is.
Yeah, and the guy from Iowa.
Miller, maybe.
Tom Miller, yeah. Spitzer was supposed to be at the meeting. He didn't show up. Instead, he put out a press release blasting us. There's another factor here that I don't think should get lost in this mess with this kind of revisionist history where people are trying to say that, you know, we didn't do things. We had a world-class ombudsman operation that operated out of Houston. Our ombudsman received literally tens of thousands of communications from customers at banks who had one kind of complaint or another. Every one of those was investigated by the ombudsman's office. They would go to the bank, try to get a response. If they thought that there was an abuse or some sort of violation, they would tell the bank to fix it, and they would refer it to the examiners on the bank to make sure it was fixed. I think that worked enormously effectively because when a bank heard from our ombudsman that they wanted a practice change, unless they were going to be totally willful and confrontational, they fixed it.
But that was only within the scope. So, for example, prepayment penalties were things that some of these state laws dealt with, but the OCC didn't take a position that prepayment penalties had to end within a certain amount of time and couldn't be over.
Well, no, I mean, if they were not illegal under federal law,
so they weren't deemed unfair under HOPA. They were just amazingly high, and so it might have been unlawful under state law, but there was the OCC couldn't find a basis for saying, "Don't charge."
Well, I don't know that we ever had complaints on prepayment penalties. I mean but you know, if prepayment penalties were unlawful under state law and didn't violate federal law, I mean, there wasn't an awful lot we could do about it in an across the board fashion. Under the Federal Trade Commission Act, only the Fed had the authority to adopt rules defining unfair and deceptive practices. Julie Williams and I really cooked up a way around that. We said that if we see a bank in an individual case engaging in an unfair or deceptive practice, we can go after them with a cease and desist order without benefit of an implementing rule, that is, without benefit of a rule that defined unsafe or unsound practices. And we did. And that and we finally got the other agencies on board with that approach. And even the Fed finally agreed that that even though the agencies didn't have rule-writing authority, that they could use their cease and desist authority in individual cases to go after unfair and deceptive practices. And that became, and there were a number of cases where we did base enforcement actions on that approach.
And do you recall what those cases might have been?
I really don't. Julie Williams would.
Okay, I'm going to show you a couple of documents that we obtained from the OCC's files at Citibank. So these are covered by a confidentiality agreement we have with the OCC. So you may have these documents, but I'm asking you to keep them confidential, which I assume you'll do. Let me describe them generically and then give you a few minutes to sort of look at them, and then I want to ask you a couple questions. So there was an approval process at Citigroup and Citibank called the Capital Markets Approval Committee. As sort of the post-Enron process developed by Citi, new products had to go through a screening process. The focus of the process was to avoid sort of legal and reputational risk, as Enron had principally been a problem because they were using structured financial products from Citibank to engage in deceptive accounting practices. So these two documents that I've given you, one is a summary of the CMAC approval process and then the minutes, and then the other separate stapled document are some OCC examiner notes. And I'm sure this sort of stuff never made it to the level of the OCC's comptroller's desk, but turning to page 2 of the longer document, the CMAC approval document, it has a diagram of a transaction on here, and if you read the first three paragraphs, it sort of lays out the basic structure of this transaction. So I'll give you time just to look at that.
Okay.
So, as I understand this transaction, it's a deal with New Century, which was one of the major subprime lenders, and what Citigroup and Citibank were doing was entering into a total return swap on the bank's books. And in essence, providing a form of liquidity as sort of warehouse financing to New Century. So, and if you go to page 3rd paragraph that the average usage was intended to be over $1 billion. So the guidance that we discussed earlier dealt with originating loans and with buying mm-hmm. loans. Obviously, technically, this kind of a transaction sort of got around that guidance because they're not buying the loan, and they're not originating the loan, but they've entered into a total return swap where they have all the credit risk and market risk associated with the loan. Yeah, it's on third page, they're not numbered. Mm-hmm. Comparable transactions in the market, it says, in other deals in the market, the swap only covers interest rate and market value risk. As New Century has no debt rating, it would be difficult to issue commercial paper at a competitive price without Citibank's full support through the total return swap. So what we've seen here, at least with this New Century deal, is Citibank's balance sheet and short-term funding essentially providing the lifeblood for one of these unregulated state-chartered lenders. And the examiner's notes are on the first paragraph section. Need follow-up items per CMAC minutes. There is no analysis or information on New Century, the issuer. Sounds to me like either a new or small client which does not have its own credit rating. Next paragraph. I'm not certain the credit risk considerations are adequately addressed. So what Citigroup and Citibank were doing, in essence, was providing the lifeblood for this new entity to fire up this subprime securitization machine. And they did so in such a manner that the OCC's guidance technically didn't apply. And this wasn't the, you know, they had a similar funding arrangement later with Argent as well. And so what we've seen is that even though national banks had a small percentage of the so-called predatory or bad subprime mm-hmm. loans that they originated, they had supplied key financing arrangements to the guys who were doing the bad stuff, including New Century and AmeriQuest. And one of the questions I have is, did the OCC at any point that you're aware of ever consider some sort of restriction on secured lending or secured lending-like derivative activities like this total return swap to prohibit national banks from extending credit to either to facilitate predatory lending or to take predatory loans as collateral?
Predatory. You're using the term that we've defined. You mean subprime?
Well, let's start with the narrow question. Did the OCC ever consider saying you can't take predatory loans as collateral and you can't finance the extension of predatory loans? Did the OCC ever consider an action like that?
We address predatory lending, and I am not aware of any situation where national banks were taking what I defined or we defined as predatory loans as collateral. I have no knowledge at all about what this was about, and I don't recall any discussion of this topic or anything like it. Note that the examiners raised questions about it, but I have no idea where this went.
But to your recollection, the OCC never considered or discussed banning loans secured by predatory loans, however the OCC wanted to define those.
I don't recall that.
I mean, you have your guidance where you say don't originate predatory loans, don't buy predatory loans, but
no, but you again. You're talking about subprime, and I define predatory loans very narrowly in the
well, no, I'm actually using the OCC says predatory and abusive lending practices. Right?
Yeah.
So here you're saying.
But we define predatory lending as equity stripping and the kinds of things that I was describing before. I never recall. I can't say that somebody in the organization wasn't concerned about it or was doing something. But I don't recall any issue ever coming to my attention that involved the questions of predatory lending as I've defined it, as we defined it, predatory loans being taken as collateral for anything. Now, the point that you're making about whether this was an evasion of the guidance that we put out on subprime loans I have never heard of this practice before. It never came to my attention, and I have no idea what the examiners may have been doing. I see that the examiners raised questions about what was going on here in August of 2003, but I have no idea where that went or where it went with Citibank, and I don't recall it coming up to my level.
Sure. I would be surprised if examiner work papers rarely rise to. So the next document I'd like to show you is the examination report for Citibank NA, the large institution. This is the examination, the transmittal letter, which is on the second page, is dated June 27, 2003. Mm-hmm. And this is the first exam after all the Enron stuff has hit the fan.
Uh-huh.
And so maybe you could take a moment just to read the first page of the transmittal letter.
Okay.
So with the large banks, and by that let's limit it to say the five largest national banks, was it your practice to look at the exam reports after they issued? Was that something you involved yourself in?
I never looked at exam reports as a routine matter. I don't recall. I don't recall ever looking at exam reports.
Were you briefed on a regular basis by the examiner in charge or the deputy comptroller for large bank supervision on the sort of?
Yeah, I believe that our large bank examiners came in and would give us briefings on the large banks. I'm not certain about that, but I believe that they did that.
What can you tell me, if at all, about what you recollect about the situation at Enron and the problems that Citibank and Citigroup had?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Okay. Well, that's a short answer. One of the comments we've heard both within the regulatory community and also from the independent financial analyst is that Citigroup or Citibank had a culture that was different than other large financial institutions into the degree to which they were siloed, that you have the guys at the London desk doing their structured financing, you had the guys at the mortgage desk putting together residential mortgage-backed securities, you had the guys at City Finance or GALS running the subprime originations, and that there was very little sort of horizontal communication at Citigroup, that they tended to operate in very autonomous units. Was that something that you had a view on at the time when you were comfortable?
I don't remember ever having discussed that.
No. Okay. All right, the last document is the formal agreement between the Comptroller's Office and Citibank. And again, this involves complex structured financial transactions, and as the first paragraph refers to the transactions with Enron. And sort of if you get to the guts of it on page 5, paragraph A, looking at the customer's intended purpose, i.e. they want to make sure that someone's not fudging their own accounting books. And B, appropriately documented analysis of the economic substance of the transaction. So that was the basic purpose of this document. Did they ever, did who's the signatory? Doug Roeder, or I believe the examiner in charge at the time was Scott Waterhouse. In picking the form of the OCC's action, be it cease and desist order, MOU, formal agreement, would they have consulted with you on that choice, or?
I doubt it. I think that was the sort of thing that was really left to the discretion of the examiners. I'm not sure I even knew that an enforcement document was being entered into. I would be surprised if I didn't, but I just don't recall.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that sort of exhausts my limited knowledge of the OCC.
Well, you're doing very well with your archaeology. Now, I have a question for you.
Sure.
The questions that were raised in this invitation letter that I got, maybe we can see from the last hour and a half, I really don't have information that for most of these questions that is responsive to the question. Really like this question about the impact of the Community Reinvestment Act on the losses by national banks. I have no idea what the impact of CRA? Well, I know Peter Wallison believes that it was the heart of the crisis.
You're a very good guess at where that question originated.
Right. we were told by banks that had very formal CRA programs that their CRA loans were some of the best loans that they had, and I have no reason to think that for the ordinary CRA programs that there was any disproportionately greater loss in that book of business than there was in their regular non CRA loans. I just don't know, but I have no reason to believe. I suspect that as banks were getting into and I have no evidence of this. This is just a hunch. I have a hunch that as banks were getting into the origination of subprime loans, they may have been trying to take CRA credit for their subprime lending beyond their formal CRA programs. I mean, these big banks had very, very good and very formalized CRA programs run by a bunch of people who knew the market for community lending and did a very good job pursuing CRA credit for the bank. But the guys who originated the subprime loans may have said, well, here's something we could take. That's purely speculation. But I've never agreed with Peter that CRA was a significant contributor to the problems.
Yeah, no. The form of your letter is basically the exact copy of the form of letter that went to Comptroller too.
Yeah.
So.
I'm not sure what to do in the way of a statement. I mean, a prepared statement. I mean, is it acceptable for me just to come up and without a statement say,
sure.
I'm here to.
Sure. I mean, you can give a statement if you want along the lines of sort of your opening discussion here, and you can say it like, look, I don't have a lot of transaction-specific or institution-specific knowledge, but I'd like to share with you my general views of my thoughts about the financial institution crisis.
Well, I'd be happy to do that if you think that would be useful. But
sure.
But I don't want people to view me as being contemptuous because I didn't prepare a written statement.
No.
Have people done that?
Have they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sort of...
Here I am. Ask me what you will.
Right.
Well, that's probably what I'll do. It doesn't make any sense for me to prepare a statement saying I can't answer questions 1, 2, so on and so on.
Sure.
And Dugan actually will have much better information than I will. All right, what I'll think about doing is just making an oral statement that describes my view about changes in the dynamics of the market and those issues about securitizations and the relation between the accounting rules. And
well, if you're gonna do an oral statement, then you should probably put something in writing as well.
Well, yeah, that's fair enough. Except.
Because the commissioners like to, you know, if you're gonna have it, they want to be able to like read it the night before. So you don't have to.
The oral statement that I was describing has a lot of BS quotient to it. So I'm not sure that would reduce easily to writing.
So that would be the one thing I advise, that if you want to make an oral statement.
That's fair enough. Yeah. Maybe I'll just say that. I don't really have information that's responsive to these questions, but I'd like to be helpful in any way I can.
Okay, fair enough. So it's 11:15, and we are concluding the interview of former Comptroller John Hawk.
Okay.